The Financial Survival Network, helping you survive and thrive in the new economy. Go to carrielutz.com and sign up for 30 free micro trainings on financial survival.
1490 WGCH, this is Kerry Lutz, and you're listening to the Financial Survival Network, which is brought to you by Miles Franklin. They've been in business selling gold and silver for over 20 years, and I'm a customer because when you buy, they ship. For more information, find them on the web at milesfranklin.com or give them a call at 800-822-8080 and get a free quote. We're having an energy roundtable today with Mickey Fulp, the mercenary geologist, and Jim Letourneau of the Big Picture Speculator, who's also a geologist, but perhaps not as mercenary as Mickey. They're both experts at connecting the investment dots, showing opportunities, and that's why you're getting to hear from them today. Hey, Mickey. Jim, welcome to the Financial Survival Network and welcome to the roundtable. I've been looking forward to it for quite a while.
Likewise, gentlemen.
Hey, we've been talking, Mickey and I, a lot about prices. What's happening? Can it go any lower? Mickey, what's the pricing picture looking like right now?
Well, the spot price has actually come off from last time we talked at the beginning of the month. Spot price for Henry Hub right now is $2.19. But interestingly enough, natural gas, which had traded in backwardation or near backwardation for most of the spring, is now very much in contango with the one-month contract, July contract, at $2.48 this morning.
Wow, that's quite a change from what we were seeing a short while ago. Jim, you're the first time for you on the Financial Survival Network. Have you been following the situation in New York with the fracking moratorium, and then there isn't a moratorium, but now there supposedly is? You paid any attention to that by any chance?
Briefly, and more, you know, almost a year ago, I think it was, you know, the New York Times came out so against fracking, and one of the fellows who was a geologist, who was one of the regulators who, I think, the administration of oil and gas exploration in New York State is actually done through the museum. Is that correct?
I'm not exactly sure, but...
it was actually done through the Museum of Natural History because there was so little activity. So there was no regulatory infrastructure in place, but some people took this person, started challenging his credentials because he had at one point worked for oil companies, and they totally slandered this poor fellow who was just a nice geologist. He had a PhD, he supervised grad students, and, you know, clearly had no vested interest in aiding the natural gas exploration process. But the challenge, I think, for New York State was it didn't have a regulatory body in place. So then it becomes a free-for-all. In places like Texas, there is a regulatory history that goes back almost 100 years, and it's a lot easier to, you know, you've got rules in place, they've been put in place over time, and people are comfortable with the industry. But in New York State, that is not the case. It's everyone gets their say. And, right, you know, in the absence of a strong structure with good people in place to monitor what's happening, it gets pretty messy pretty quickly.
Yeah, Mickey, you've been following New York, I know, right?
Well, I have, and that came about partially because I spent a week after the Hard Assets Conference traveling around upstate New York, went to Cooperstown, went to Woodstock, and it's quite divided there. It's become an issue that is completely bipartisan. There are people that are proponents of hydrofracking, very strong proponents. There are people that are very negative and anti, and it's just absolutely not going to happen in my backyard types. And I noticed that when I was traveling around upstate New York, a lot in the country, and some through various villages and towns, and you would see pockets of neighborhoods with anti-fracking signs, and then the next neighborhood over, you would not see one sign. And I suspect that that may have to do somewhat with the people that have been approached by the various oil and gas companies and have signed leases or negotiating for leases versus people that have not been approached. Or we're now seeing things such as Chesapeake Energy is being forced to renegotiate contracts that were signed pre-moratorium in New York, and Chesapeake's thesis would be that they have been delayed, therefore those contracts should be continued, whereas the state of New York is now forcing Chesapeake to renegotiate some of those at higher prices.
Yeah, unbelievable. Well, that's the way things work in New York, and they're clueless about it. We always talk about the risks, Mickey. Jim, your perception of the risks of hydrofracking?
Well, I think the two main things that people against fracking bring up is the potential for contamination of groundwater, and the other one is earthquakes. And to speak to the first thing, they typically will show someone able to light their tap water on fire. They don't really say whether they could light their tap water on fire 50 years ago or not. It's just, oh my God, this tap water's on fire. I actually studied carbon isotope geochemistry, which is like fingerprinting for natural gas. And most of the time, in fact, all the examples that I'm aware of, these natural gas emissions coming out of someone's tap are naturally occurring. They've been historically present, and it's just a very good visual that scares people. It's very effective. Yoko Ono has put a picture of a tap that was on fire on her blog. People make movies about it, and they don't want to hear anything about the science. It's a little frustrating for the scientific community because they're going, well, this isn't the problem that was caused by fracking. Why are you so upset? If there was an example of massive groundwater contamination, it's not going to come from fracking. It'll probably come from a sewage system or a feedlot or an industrial plant. If people are really worried about groundwater contamination, there are probably two or three or four other potential sources that would be way higher than fracking.
That's what my research has revealed. It's this emotional stew that has emerged. And we've also got like another technology coming in, propane gel, which promises to really erase the entire debate because you're not using water, you're not using many chemicals, and when you do get the gas out, the gel, which you use to frack, basically vaporizes and all your chemicals are gone, right?
Exactly. And the other reason they do that is it's actually, it depends on the formation, but it actually allows more gas to flow out because in some formations, if you have drilling fluid at a high pressure invading the fractures, it'll plug off some of the formation and it's hard to clean that up. And so there's two, the one reason obviously is it uses less water, which is great, but it also can provide higher production rates.
Yeah, and quicker development of the well because you don't have to get all the water pumped out of it as well.
Exactly.
It's just an amazing thing that we see so much benefit to this technology. The fact is the United States and Canada, they're producing more oil than they produced in a long, long time, and yet the controversy seems to have no end to it. Mickey, what kind of production benefits are we seeing from hydrofracking across the hemisphere?
Well, the U.S. and to a certain degree Canada are at the forefront in hydrofracking technology. And so what we see in the U.S. is starting with the Barnett Shale in central Texas in the Fort Worth area. In the mid-2000s, we saw a whole new gas field developed in this area. And the net result has been we have an abundance, in fact, an overabundance of natural gas in the United States right now. And as you and I have discussed previously, the problem we have in the United States is the lack of infrastructure to process, ship, transport, store that natural gas and basically get it to the places where it can be processed and used. So that has contributed in great part to the drop in natural gas prices, an issue we've discussed extensively. The oil to gas ratio, although it has come down, it's less than 35 right now. At one point in the winter, it was well over 50. The net result is we have an abundance of natural gas in the United States that we are not using right now. And it's a cleaner burning fuel. It produces much less greenhouse gases, very important, and developing more in the petrochemical industry. So the future of natural gas looks very good to me in terms of supply, and it could help wean us from oil production in the United States, of which we import something on the order of 40% of our oil or more right now. It could help us become a net gas exporter if we can develop the technology to get it to places where it's needed and can be used.
Leave it to you, Mickey. Like, we're already talking about controversial fracking and you're bringing up climate change. My inbox is going to be overflowing with people upset with me. So, but Jim, you're analyzing the, Jim, you've had some articles recently, some analysts calling for the price of oil to fall to $50 a barrel. How realistic is that?
It's extremely realistic. I mean, the forecasting of oil prices, I'm actually just writing a piece on it. It's really challenging because no matter what your forecast is, it's going to be wrong. And, you know, when I'm on a panel and people are saying, Jim, what do you think the oil price will be? I usually say, how the hell should I know? Because the safe forecast is plus minus $10 a barrel of the current price. But in reality, you're going to probably be two standard deviations above or below the price, and it's pretty tough to know. We were talking about this just in March, and I was the low forecaster because I said $80. I knew it couldn't stay at around 100 or 110, and so that's a real challenge. But there are lots of reasons to have lower oil. One of them includes people are driving less. You know, I saw an article because kids are on Facebook so much, they're driving less. We have the cheapest natural gas in the world right now in North America, and we're just starting to develop oil plays the same way, using horizontal drilling, etc. Production in North Dakota has ramped up. It's just starting to ramp up in Texas. So there are lots of reasons. You know, for every major oil field in the world, it's going to have a world-class source rock associated with it, which will be an organic-rich shale, and we're just starting to play around with them. In another 5 years, we could have a similar situation that we saw with natural gas. No one saw the natural gas abundance coming, and now we've got roughly 100-year supply. We don't need a 200-year supply. Oil could be heading down the same path because we're just starting to work. You know, there's more than one Bakken shale out there. You know, there's a lot of equivalent type Bakkens that are just starting to be explored and tested, and it's going to take a few years before we really figure out how to get them all to work. So that's bullish on supply. And Lord knows if the Middle East starts to develop any of its unconventional shale resources, how much they'll have. So it's a good, we're kind of on the path to energy independence.
Yeah, so much for peak oil then, you're saying, effectively, right?
Well, the planet is a finite volume, but there's a lot of oil out there, and especially even at $80, it's still a great price for oil supplies to keep coming on stream.
Yeah, that's pretty much been my perception for a long time, because I usually believe that the consensus, the conventional view, is almost always wrong. If you don't believe it, just ask them about what the price is going to be, and they're clueless. So, Mickey, how do you make money off of all these trends here? Is there a way where you, the average investor, to exploit these opportunities?
Well, at this stage, I've been watching natural gas for quite a while and have specific gas companies, and most of those have tried to move to NGL-rich reservoirs or oil-dominated reservoirs. Right now, I'm still sitting on the sidelines, waiting for an indication that we are going to have stronger natural gas prices. Certainly, there are companies that are very beaten up that are on my short list. But in my opinion, it's just not time to move into those at this present time.
And what's your thinking on it, Jim? Is there an opportunity for investors?
You know, the opportunity is to stand aside. I completely agree with Mickey on this. We don't know. And even in oil, the bounce, you know, we forget that it wasn't that long ago that West Texas was below $40 a barrel in 2008. So that could happen again, and it, you know, the price will eventually settle out. But you know, the trend is down for now, and you know, I was on a pretty interesting discussion where someone said, "Well, something will happen in the Middle East, or something will happen in Venezuela, or something will happen in Nigeria." There's all this political risk providing a floor to oil prices. And what could happen is we could have a major political event that everyone thinks should make the oil price go up, and that would be the time to really watch. Because if the oil price doesn't go up, that's a real solid indicator that we've got, you know, not only natural gas abundance, but oil abundance as well. And I know the peak oil people hate it, and they love to pick out examples of, they all become experts in what doesn't work. And they all become experts in how not to develop an oil field and all of the mistakes that are made. But they tend to discount and ignore any new technology or any success. And, you know, they're just sort of permanently locked into the fact that we're going to run out. And I think the transition isn't going to be that difficult. I think we're going to have a lot of oil for a long period of time, which will allow us to switch to alternatives. And the alternatives have to get cheaper. You know, we want cheap energy. It's a real benefit to the economy. I think low natural gas prices have been a great boon to the North American economy. It's made electricity lower in a lot of places. And we don't hear about that, right? We just hear about problems all the time instead of, you know, people, we like to get excited and we like to be fearful. That gets attention, you know, but cheap natural gas and low electricity prices, people don't seem to get excited about that as well.
Yeah, they're always stressing the negatives and never looking at the silver lining, which to me is all silver lining because, like you said, lower energy prices. We have Exxon building a huge petrochemical plant with the natural gas feedstock, and we're going to see a bunch of other companies do it from all over the world because at $2 a million BTUs, you can't beat the value of it. Especially compared to oil, even if oil comes down, is it going to come down to the natural 6-to-1 ratio? I think that's really doubtful. $12 a barrel, is that in the future, Mickey?
Well, I certainly hope not, because it's going to wreak havoc on many people's equities portfolios. What I see with the opposition, this rabid opposition to hydrofracking, especially in certain parts of the Northeast, is it reminds me very much of what went on in the nuclear industry post Three Mile Island. Now we're going back nearly, well, over 30 years now, but there became it became a focal point for the environmental community. And I think that's what hydrofracking has become now. We all talk our own books. We all vote our own pocketbooks. And there is a very well-funded environmental community that has to be anti-something, and hydrofracking appears to be the flavor of the year, or perhaps even the flavor of the decade here. And we look at the environmental community now, which views nuclear as green for the most part, because it does not produce greenhouse gases. What we need is a balance. Our energy solutions in the United States, and I think we very well can become energy independent in the coming decades, has to be a mix. It has to be a mix of things that provide baseload electricity, and of course, uranium is a big part of that. Coal is a big part of that, and natural gas is increasingly becoming a part of that. We have to have renewables, which in my opinion will always be a small and relatively high cost part of surge demand, but it all fits together. We've got to attack it from all fronts, and the goal, of course, in the United States Canada does not have this problem, but we certainly do in the United States, is we continue to export our inflation worldwide by buying, trading dollars, by printing more dollars for oil. And the sooner we can reduce that dependency, the better off we're all going to be.
Yeah, and the other meme that's ended is the one that the U.S. only has 3% of the world's energy reserves and is responsible for 25% of the world's energy demand. The sooner we don't hear that one again, the better, because it's totally false, right, Jim?
Well, it's funny. The definition of reserves, there's sort of a step change periodically, and it happened to Canada because it's still just starting to show up in statistics. Oil sands were not thought of as reserves. They were still experimental and not proven, and it took, you want to see a few years of history, et cetera. And suddenly on the books, it was, Canada, if you include the oil sands production in oil, it's a big step up, and that's what's going to happen with natural gas. People may not believe, the numbers yet, but ultimately, I think it's an easy 100-year supply at pretty low prices. The United States, in spite of its high energy demand, is also pretty good at coming up with solutions. And solar is going to get cheaper. It's following Moore's law, but it's, maybe 10 or 15 years away to be competitive with our current energy infrastructure. But I think the thing that the peak oil people tend to forget is our human ingenuity, right, and technology and our improvements. And we're continually improving everything and all processes. It moves pretty slow, actually, in the oil and gas industry, but it still happens. And, I don't see a problem with the lowest natural gas prices in the world, and I don't see a problem with oil prices heading lower. On the consumer side, as an investor, I get a little nervous because, you like to think of the oil business as a stable business with regular cash flow, and then, some of these companies pay dividends, and, you don't want to see prices get too low. But ultimately, I'm a flaming optimist. I can't help it. the world is getting better every year. And if we look, you don't have to look back too far. Look at what kind of computer you had. Look at what your entertainment choices were. It's getting better all the time. There's always going to be people, kicking and screaming into these massive improvements. But I think they're going to move ahead. I don't think fracking's going to be stopped. It's got a pretty solid track record. And I think that's going to be one of the things that allow us to have cheaper energy.
Yeah, well, that's good news ahead, definitely, because like Mickey said, the exportation of inflation to the rest of the world by the U.S., it's going to come back and hit us at some point. The more energy self-sufficient we are, the better we're going to get through it. So to find you, Jim, where do we go on the internet? What's your main site?
JimLaterno.com.
And Mickey, you're mercenarygeologist.com, and you've got what's your radio site again?
Mercenarygeologist.fm, and for a bilingual audience, in simplified Chinese, mercenarygeologist.asia.
All right, excellent. Well, gentlemen, hey, thanks so much for being on, and hopefully we will contribute a little bit to perhaps damping down on the controversy. But then again, when you're dealing with ideologues and fanatics, I don't know if reason can ever play a part in that debate. So, Jim, thanks for being on first time.
And a Mickey, pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, and Mickey, we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, Carrie. Always a pleasure. Thanks a lot, Jim.